All right, guys, before we jump in, I want to tell you real quick about the 0 to 100 Elite Mastermind. This is our own high-level group for serious real estate investors looking to scale fast. Inside, we share deals, strategies, and we build real relationships all to grow our cash flow portfolios. And you know what? Most members actually add 10-plus units in their first year. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to our podcast guests for direct Q&A. If you're chasing time freedom through real estate, check it out at 0to100tribe.com. That's Z-E-R-O-T-O, the number 100, tribe.com. Now, enjoy the show.
If you own real estate and it burns to the ground, you're left with the actual land. You're left with some tangible asset in which you can still make a profit out of. You have opportunity.
Being on some chips, we go 0 to 100. Real quick.
Welcome to the 0 to 100 podcast. I'm Travis Dillard, and we're all about scaling a cash flow real estate portfolio from 0 to over 100 units and achieving your retirement number one, or R1. That's where passive income from real estate replaces your day job and gives you complete time freedom, which is the new currency of the rich.
I'm Mitchell England, and I'm thrilled to have you on board. With our combined real estate holdings valued over $100 million, learn from us and others who've achieved time freedom through cash flow real estate.
This is Gabriel Hamill. Here at 0 to 100, you will not hear us talk about house flipping, spec homes, wholesaling, or land banking. We are only about achieving time freedom through buying and holding cash flow real estate. So remember, if R1 is the destination, real estate is the vehicle, and cash flow is the gas. Now go out there and buy some cash flow real estate.
Welcome to another episode of the 0 to 100 podcast. I am here with my co-host, Mitchell England, Travis Dillard.
The Mitchell England.
The Mitchell England. And our guest today, Ashley Wilson. Ashley, you have quite a bio. Ashley Wilson is the co-founder of Conference Connect, founder and CEO of Bar Down Investments, co-founder of Apartment Addicts, and co-founder of, is it House It Look?
How's It Look.
How's It Look. Best-selling author of The Only Woman in the Room. It's knowledge and inspiration from 20 women real estate investors, a regular contributor to Rent Magazine, and has hosted several Bigger Pockets. I don't know what Bigger Pockets is. Multifamily series. She started investing in real estate in 2009 and has been involved in over $165 million in transactions and has managed over $13 million in construction with both single family and multifamily across over 1,500 units. In addition to operating her own investments, Ashley provides consulting and mentorship to other operators and investors. She's been featured in Business Insider, regular contributor to Rent Magazine, 2019 Apartment Owner of the Year nominee, 2022 Connect CRE Women in Real Estate Award recipient, 2022 winner of the American Apartment Owners Association Best in Multifamily Investing Membership Program, Penn State University Real Estate Advisory Board member, 2023 and 2024 Pet Community of the Year finalist, 2022 HAA Property of the Year runner-up, 2024 Marquis Who's Who, 2024 Mainline Parent Women of Influence Award winner, and 2024 Nextdoor Neighborhood Favorite of the Augusta Court Apartments. Ashley, you are such a slacker. Welcome.
You make me feel like a total loser, Ashley. Thank you for jumping on.
Welcome to the 0 to 100 podcast show, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me. To be honest, I don't think anyone's ever read the whole thing, so it's kind of a little embarrassing.
That's not embarrassing. That's awesome.
You've done a lot in the real estate world, outside of the real estate world.
What makes you say that?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, right.
What's pet community, Ashley? There was something about pet community. Did I miss that?
Yeah, so it's it celebrates apartments that are pet friendly and are welcoming of pets and go above and beyond to make it a pet friendly community as opposed to just a regular, you know, residential or commercial property.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, you've done a lot, but let's go back to young Ashley. Ashley before she was investing in real estate. What got you into real estate? How did real estate get on your-
She probably started when she was 4, right? That's great.
I actually started in clinical research and development. So I worked for 3 major pharmaceutical companies, not obviously all at the same time, but I worked for Sanofi Aventis, then I worked for Wyeth, which is now owned by Pfizer. And then finally, I worked for GlaxoSmithKline. And I, at Glaxo, I actually left Glaxo and transitioned to real estate, but I was the director of global project management for vaccine development. So essentially what we did is we ran, well, the people I managed, I used to do it, but then I got promoted to director, which was those folks, they would run clinical trials prior to regulatory approval and submission. So think of, like, for example, the pandemic, the COVID vaccine, that was fast tracked, but typically vaccines have to go through a trial period and then you take the data and then submit it to the local regulatory approval. In the US, it's the FDA, in Europe, it's the EMA. So we work with different governing bodies. We work with CDC, the WHO. And that's what I did prior to investing in real estate.
So obviously a very natural transition from that to real estate. I mean,
vaccines to real estate. That's what I did.
What's interesting, though, is that it actually worked in my favor. I mean, that's very fast forwarding the story, but it worked in my favor when the pandemic came around because I had experience working with the regulatory body. So I knew what the protocol was for a pandemic. But backtrack a little bit, how I transitioned was my now husband, I was dating him at the time, he found bigger pockets. He was looking for alternative investments outside of the stock market. We both were in agreement that the stock market wasn't the right investment vehicle for us for retirement. And we looked for our alternative means. And he stumbled across bigger pockets and real estate, and kind of the rest is history. But we both were just really opposed to the stock market, and we thought there has to be a better way. And what are the wealthy doing as opposed to, like, the regular W-2s doing? Like, where is the difference? And we wanted to try to exploit that.
Ashley, I got a question for you, because when you talk about the stock market, it's near and dear to my heart. I fall in your camp as well. And I'm wondering, I have my own reasons, but I'm wondering why you decided. Are you out of stocks altogether, by the way? That's the first question.
Yes.
Okay, me too. And I'm told, I'm like, you're crazy. It's going bananas. And I'm like, but there's no fundamentals backing it. I don't know why it's going bananas. And I have no control over it. What were your reasons, if you were to sort of summarize it into a few bullets, why you would look at alternative investments as opposed to the stock market?
There's so many reasons, to be honest with you. It's speculative. It's also, to your point, it's not backed by any sort of, you know, backing. I always like to give the example that if you own real estate and it burns to the ground, you're left with the actual land. You're left with some tangible asset in which you can still, you know, make a profit out of. You have opportunity. If a company up and folds, you are left with literally nothing. You can also speak to leverage, like the ability to leverage. I mean, there are a little nuances in the stock market where you can use leverage, but not to the ability that you can, for example, with real estate. So we like that. But really, one of the major reasons, and I think a lot of people talk on this point, so I don't have to go into it because you can find resources elsewhere, which are the tax benefits. The tax benefits are astronomical.
Wait, there's tax benefits to real estate?
Who would have thought, right? I mean, one of the reasons we even transitioned into multifamily, because we didn't start in multifamily, but we kind of made a similar mistake in a different asset class. So we didn't like the stock market because there were no tax benefits. And then we went into an asset class that didn't have tax benefits, which was pretty stupid. And it was within the real estate sector. I mean, it didn't have great tax benefits. If you want to maximize the tax benefits, obviously multifamily is a great vehicle to do that with. So now, of course, I'm not a CPA. Check with your CPA on everything I'm saying. But for us, what we found was real estate was just a better avenue and a faster avenue to grow our wealth.
What was that asset class that you were in that you didn't feel like had the tax benefits that multifamily had?
Flipping. So we were doing flipping. We started off kind of like, I wouldn't say low end flipping, because we're anywhere from ARVs were 300,000 to 500,000, kind of mid range flipping in our area. I mean, I know every area is different. But then we then transitioned into you know, multi-million dollar flipping. And when you're paying six figure tax bills, you're like, what am I doing? Like, all I did was create myself another job.
Working for the government.
Yes. That's literally what I said to myself was I got the tax bill and I was like, I did that house for free for the government. I did that entire flip for free. And that's when the light bulb went off and I was like, I can't do this anymore.
You're providing housing for housing so the government doesn't have to? And you're paying the government the money.
Yeah, it's like the first like three, it's like the first 3 or 4 months sometimes. I mean, when you break it up, you're like the whole first quarter is just like the federal government or the state government, whatever that is. I loved how you said too, like you wanted to start paying attention to what the rich are doing. I think a lot of people miss that. They just do what everybody else is doing and they're like, they expect a different result. But like, if you follow what the middle class is doing, then you're going to be middle class or the lower class. So like, I don't know, just getting beyond that, I think that's been a part of my search is like, what game are they playing and how do I go play that same game? So I love that you said that.
What's interesting is that you also see that though in real estate, right? You see that in real estate because people follow the masses and they follow, yep, they find real estate and they're like, okay, where's the red ocean again? I love my comfort zones in the red ocean. I want to swim with all these other people.
Yep.
Instead of saying, what is it that I actually want? We interviewed a dentist one time who told me that he found real estate and he found it through friends who needed cash flow. So he pursued asset classes that gave him cash flow only to realize he doesn't need cash flow. He owns all these dental practices. He has a lot of cash flow. He needs tax write-offs. And because of that, he actually transitioned his strategy and started investing in oil and oil refineries because they had greater tax advantages for him personally. Once again, do your own research. But I'm just saying that it's interesting how we kind of, you know, have this fear of stepping into the unknown. We then take the risk, but then revert back to our tendencies of following the masses again.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, that's flipping, for example, I think is maybe one of those where it's like, hey, I might be a real estate investor. All of a sudden you're flipping and you're paying the government a bunch in taxes, but you're doing what everybody else is doing. Therefore, you're going to get subpar results versus like, I like how you said too, like step back, like what do you actually need? That dentist didn't need cash flow. He needed tax versus other people going, hey, I want tax flow or cash flow, you know, to live a big life. Or I mean, like understanding your why and why you're getting in at all.
They say the rich make their wealth in three areas, private equity, private credit, so private lending and real estate. And so, I mean, that's where I hear. And I like Mitch said, like, what do you want? Tax benefits, cash flow, or appreciation? Because there's a lot of investments you can go into where you're going to get no cash flow, but you're going to get more appreciation. Obviously, the 0 to 100 tribe is all about cash flow. It's like, how do you generate enough cash flow to replace your living and lifestyle expenses? We call that getting to R1 or retirement number one. So everything we're talking about is long-term and hold cash flow assets. So you guys are flipping. You started out flipping houses. You realize, Mitch said you're working the first quarter of the year for the government. I'd argue maybe the first two quarters of the year for the government, depending on your tax bracket and what. If you're in California, I think it's the first 3.5 quarters of the year you work for the government. And then they give you like a pop can in return. So you're doing that. Yeah, you're flipping houses, you're working for the government, and then you're like, whoa, wait a minute, this doesn't work. Then what? Then what happens? And did you guys decide what you wanted to do? Was it cash flow? Was it appreciation? Did you know? Did you actually have the foresight to sort of figure that out? Like, walk us through that thought pattern.
So the whole thought pattern actually started, we didn't originally start with flipping. We originally started with house hacking, short-term rentals, then we did a couple long-term rentals, and then we went into flipping. And what's interesting is now, you know, I have a completely different perspective. I think that there are three different types of people. They're either people who are in wealth building mindset, wealth preservation, or tax advantage. And everyone's on some sort of continuum of those three different metrics. But for us, we weren't on a capital preservation. And initially, we weren't on a tax advantage, even though we said we were. Our actions didn't support that. Our actions supported that we were on a wealth building mindset. And wealth building mindset people are typically people who take greater risks because they're trying to push their wealth, right? So for us, we stumbled on flipping for a lot of reasons. You know, I'm a former Division I athlete. My husband's he used to be a professional athlete. we live and die by the saying that you play to your strengths, right? You want to exploit your strengths. My strengths are my dad's a general contractor. He's had his own business for over 45 years. I grew up in construction. I'm very comfortable in that space. And then I'm coming from an operational background with respect to corporate America. So it married really well in terms of, okay, let's go into flipping. Let's systematize this business, which we did. So to put in perspective of numbers, our first house took us 9.5 months to flip and a year from acquisition to sale. Our third house, which was a larger scope, also a full gut rehab, took us 9.5 weeks from purchase to sale. And we made over 2x in that 9.5 weeks, not prorated, 2.5x net. So if you look at it from a perspective of like where our mindset was at, we were like, okay, let's build this cash flowing business. And the reason we were on this mindset of let's build this cash flowing business is I left my W-2 and my husband was a professional athlete at the time. And our mindset was, let's build up a business that allows you to retire on your own, you know, accord. Like if you want to retire, it's on your terms. It's not because you're not getting another offer. It's because you've decided this is no longer the career for me. And that's exactly what happened. So for that sake, I'm actually very grateful for that part of our experience and our journey. I'm also very grateful because I got to work with my dad. So there's like an emotional tie in there. But we built this business solely to replace his income and my income. And we achieved that. So that was something that was like, okay, check off the little tick box of we achieved this. Now we're looking at it and saying, okay, yeah, but we're paying a shit ton of taxes, right? And that made it from, you know, when you start to understand real estate and understand tax concepts and understand that the tax code are really the rules to the game of life and you're not playing the game correctly, you start to say to yourself, how do I play this game better? And that's when we looked for alternative vehicles, and commercial real estate was clearly the front runner for the best way to play the game.
Ashley, how long did it take you to realize that? Because obviously you had built a successful business. You had the operational background, you had the construction background growing up in that and with your dad. To me, it seems like it'd almost be harder to transition out of that because you had built a successful business and then you had a tax problem that you were trying to solve. So how long did you keep that flipping business going? You know, how long was that until you realized like, oh shit, I don't want to pay all these taxes. There's another way to invest that would actually put me at more of an advantage.
In the third year of flipping, I realized it, but it was very difficult, to be honest with you, because you know, you talk about working with families and everyone always says like the hardest part of working with families is, you know, there's this comfort and familiarity that makes it difficult to like kind of focus on brass tacks sometimes. For me, that wasn't the difficult part. The difficult part was, you know, the saying like you never should hire someone you should fire. Well, you should never partner with someone that you could never not partner with, right? Mm-hmm. And it was very hard for me to be comfortable saying to my dad, hey, I want to do something else that I knew he didn't want to do. So I was very fearful that he wouldn't, not that he wouldn't be successful, that but he wouldn't be able to create the same business. I have a very business. I am very driven. I work hundreds and hundreds of hours constantly. I'm definitely a workhorse. And typically people who have that mindset can't be surrounded by other people who are like that because they like cannibalize each other. So typically the groups that I work really well with are people who are okay with me being the driver and them kind of taking my lead. And that's my dad. My dad was very comfortable with me being the driver on every decision we made, like down to what house we purchased and also the finishes. Like that's the scope of, you know, all the decision making I was doing. So it was very difficult for me personally and emotionally to make that, you know, that sever that partnership. But what's crazy is my dad actually wasn't bothered by it at all. Huh. It was all in my head. So it took me like probably 3 or 4 years to pull the trigger, but I knew that I wanted to do something else. And then also geographically, my husband's career had taken us to Europe. So we were in Europe, and commercial real estate is definitely a very, and it used to be even more, a very relationship driven business. So if you're not in the room, especially as a woman, you know, to try to create virtual relationships with the good old boys in Texas to try to get, you know, 100 plus units, that just doesn't happen. So it, a lot of it had to kind of come together. My husband had to retire for us to be able to transition into this business because I had to physically be on location, make a name for myself, develop these relationships with these brokers and sellers to build trust. And that is another piece to the puzzle that took some time to actually come to fruition.
Do you think that flipping, because we have a lot of people in our tribe that are flippers that want to get into cash flow real estate. Do you think that you got out of flipping because you were like very analytical about it? You understood the tax, you understood the commitment. Do you think flipping is kind of addicting to people?
It's literally a drug, because every time you sell a house, you get a massive payment, and it like literally creates this like brain fog of you forgetting all the like rigmarole that got you to that closing table, right? Like all the headaches, all the, you know, and honestly, you only have to be in a flipping for a couple of years before you eventually come across a lawsuit. Like real estate lawsuits are a dime a dozen. Everyone's, if you've been in the business long enough, you've been involved in a lawsuit. You go through one lawsuit and flipping and you're like, what am I doing?
I see a lot of flippers, you know, recovering flippers or soon to be recovering flippers, flippers that want to get into buy and hold cash flow real estate. You seem to transition pretty quick. Like the light bulb went off. You realized you had a operational type business that was more of a, I don't know, maybe a job, but also didn't set you up for a good tax position. But a lot of people have a hard time transitioning. So that was going to be my question to you. Like, why is it that you think a lot of flippers have a hard time transitioning from flipping, which is making money, to buy and hold cash flow real estate, which I think of as building long-term wealth, which are two very different things?
I think there are a few different components which make it very difficult. The first component is flipping is a high bandwidth, high attention type of business. And when you're switching to long-term holds, it's high bandwidth upfront, but it's also like a trust and verify along the way. So if you set it up correctly in the beginning, then you can put like a lot of systems in place. And I think that it helps you when you're in the thick of it. But in the beginning, you have to trade off your bandwidth, right? Because you're flipping, it's taking up all your time. You have to say to yourself, like, I need to carve out time that I'm specifically spending to learn this new business and build a team. I think a second piece to it is flipping. Most people start off flipping by themselves. It's easy to do on their own. When you're doing buy and holds, when you're doing smaller buy and holds, it's obviously something that you can stomach as one person. But when you're doing something like, for example, I've never done a duplex before. My first multi-unit was 124 units.
That's it? And that's 105, I think. So,
well, it's like hard for someone to go from being that person who got attracted to real estate because they were probably that fifth grade kid who, when there was a group assignment, was like, just show up for the presentation day. I'm taking care of everything. I don't need you guys to help me. Because that's the type of mindset you need to have to be attracted to real estate in the first place and go away from everyone else who's doing a W-2 to all of a sudden going, oh, wait, hey, I can go further, faster with a team. And that's a different skill set. Like, how do you identify the right people to partner with when you want to grow larger? How also do you build and identify who the next best either hire or partner is? So it's a different skill set, right? But the third thing, which is probably the most talked about, most, you know, like buzzworthy, is the capital. So when people are flipping, it's very easy to conceptualize, okay, I just need a $20,000 down payment or $40,000. Either the people have it or they have access to it through a private lender, hard money lender, someone. They can fathom finding $20,000. When you're doing like a, you know, I'll take, for example, one property we had, one of the earlier ones, it was a $10 million raise. $10 million on, you know, a larger apartment seems like, how am I, I'm going to put this property on contract under contract before I have the equity lined up. Where in residential, you typically have the equity lined up before you have the property under contract. So it's a different process in terms of the transaction too. And I think a lot of people, they're not used to. I know for us personally, we also didn't do it that way. Like, we limited our growth for years based on how much money we had. So we started using a bank lender to help us our second year of flipping, but we never took on another investor. And we figured out we could only do four houses at a time. And it wasn't due to bandwidth. It was due to financial bandwidth, right? Not physical bandwidth. And because we never like used that skill, I never learned raising money on and how to raise money until I had been in real estate investing for 10 years. Like, how many other people do you know don't know how to raise money after they've been in real estate investing for 10 years? That's a huge deficit. Well, Mitch, we're aligned. Like,
I think it was 20 years for me.
It took like 13 or 14 years. And I was like, wait, I heard people raising money. I mean, it was, yeah, I'm slow.
I love that you said that because, you know, people that might be listening are going, wow, 104 units. Like, I can't even fathom that. We talk about this in the tribe. Like, if you really want to scale, you need to buy bigger properties. If you want to buy bigger properties, because bigger properties, less risk, big, more cash flow, more upside, force appreciation. You can hire management so you don't own a bunch of jobs, right? But also, like, if you want to buy bigger properties, you need to raise capital. And we'd say attract capital. Like, how do you attract capital? I'm curious, when you got to that, when you had that four house bandwidth, and many people are listening, well, how do I, because that there's a big mind block for people to raise capital. Like, I can't, they think it's like, I always say it's like a creepy Starbucks meeting with a PowerPoint presentation and like, hey, can I get your money? You know, how did you guys attract capital? How did you guys raise capital, whether it was for flipping or multifamily stuff? And maybe how can you educate people to overcome self-limiting beliefs around that?
The first time I ever raised capital was for the 124 unit. And someone once told me, and it's very common in this industry to hear this saying, that you're not asking for money, you're offering an opportunity. And I never got that. Even when people told me that, like, I was like, oh my God, that's such like a, you know, of course you say that, like, you're great at raising capital, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's not helpful. And it wasn't until like it really sunk in and I went through the process and started to see some people be like, wait a second, like, I can invest outside of the stock market in something else. And like, once you realize that you're also educating people and you truly are helping people, like, you're helping them see other opportunities, whether they invest with you or not, you're helping them because you're educating them, that really makes a huge difference. And it's almost like you act as if, right? Like, you act as if you're helping people, and all of a sudden it does start coming to you. I know that's very cliche to say, but it really does. And I think that there's only really two ways to be successful in life. One is you do massive impact for the few, or you do little impact for the masses. And to me, when you're doing investing and you're doing, especially for us, we only typically work with accredited investors. So we're providing massive value for the few. You realize that you can create a business off of that, right? And you can create value and help folks out to see alternative investing vehicles that they can participate in. For me, that's something that, like, the first time I really didn't realize, but then the second time I was like, okay, this makes sense. But to be honest with you, I am not a good salesperson at all. That's one of my weaknesses. I will never be able to like sell a pen to someone, as like, you know, that's the example everyone always uses. People invest with me because they know that I'm passionate about the asset. So if they're going to invest with me, it's because they're saying to themselves, she's a good operator. She's putting her money into, she believes in this investment. She has a track record and she's a workhorse. And I'm going to bet on that, as opposed to like some other, you know, good dog, horse and pony show kind of thing. Right. So to me, like, lean into your strengths. If you're not good at being salesy, don't be salesy. Like, talk about your interests, talk about what you're passionate about, and people invest with people they know, like, and trust. And if you're pretending to be someone else, you're not trustworthy. So I would say to do that. And then also to your point about, you know, if you want to scale and do bigger deals, when you do bigger deals, you can afford to bring more people in. So if it's not comfortable for you, like, to be honest, real estate makes me really excited. Going golfing and dinners, that's not fun for me. So I focus on the real estate and managing the asset that and acquisitions. And Jay Scott, my partner, he's awesome and he loves doing investor relations and he loves doing the legal side of things. I don't enjoy doing that piece of it. So partner with people that, you know, you have other alignments with, but you aren't the same person in terms of strengths. So that way you provide value, your partner provides value. And that way together as a company, you have no holes.
So I've got a question that this is like, I feel like we could talk to you all day. Like there's so much to unpack, but like going back to that first deal where you said you had not bought a duplex and then you went to 124, right? That was your first one?
Yep.
Will you talk about how much capital do you need to raise for that? I don't know if you said 10 million or what the number was, but like, and then what did that look like and what did that feel like emotionally? Because I'm putting myself in your shoes going, I'm like shaking. I'm going, oh no, what did we do? We're in contract on this thing. Can I pull it off? Who do I call? What does my pitch look like? I'm not a salesperson, but I got to talk to people. Like, was it uncomfortable? Was it scary? Where did you find these people to invest? I don't know. Maybe walk through that leap.
So going off of leaning into your strengths, I knew I wanted to be in commercial real estate. I knew I wanted to be multifamily. And I had done a pretty thorough analysis. My husband and I, taking a step back, when we knew flipping wasn't right, we actually wrote out 22 different real estate asset businesses we could have pursued. And for 3 months, every single Saturday, we dissected every single business and we did like high school debate style and debated until we landed on multifamily. Once we landed on multifamily, I investigated it thoroughly and figured out that the avatar of someone who goes into multifamily is typically someone who most of the time has a pretty good financial situation. They're typically engineers. They might be doctors. They're normally high income earners. Very few people go from like no real estate experience into multifamily, right? So they have some sort of background experience, but what they don't typically have is construction knowledge. So most, especially syndication teams, they lack someone who has construction knowledge. They outsource that to a construction company. And what ends up happening is then they don't have alignment. Construction companies get paid on a percentage of the total cost of construction. So already you're not aligned, right? And solution-wise, you know, these assets are typically being held for 3 to 5 years. They're coming up with solutions that last 10 to 20 years. You don't need solutions that last 10 to 20 years. You need solutions that last through your whole period and then a couple years after that so you don't get retraded on, you know, a sale. So to me, where my value lied was I am very well versed in construction. I can run construction. So I went out as soon as we identified commercial real estate, I went out and told my network that I wanted to get into multifamily. If anyone had any contacts of someone that I could connect with in large multifamily, that I would be really interested in speaking with them. Literally one of the first people I reached out to, I didn't know this at the time, they also had a business of large multifamily. They were under contract for 124 units. While they were under contract, one of the buildings burnt to the ground and they were in the process of negotiating the insurance proceeds so that they could rebuild the building themselves, but no one on their team had construction knowledge. They asked me to come on as the construction manager, as a GP. So right away, I stepped in and managed that piece of it. But prior to that, getting to the closing table, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was around $3 million that we were supposed to raise. And we fell short of that. So we did not collect an acquisition fee on this deal because typically the last money that you raise on a syndication goes towards your acquisition fee. We were going to raise that afterwards. It never ended up happening. Unfortunately, overall, it was just like a bad partnership group, but it gave me a lot of good experience that I'm forever grateful for. One of the things that scared me, to your point of what was I scared about, I wasn't scared about the construction. I was able to rebuild the entire building in 6 months. I look back, I honestly can't even believe that that was able to be achieved, but I was really out to prove myself in this position. But one of the things I was scared about early on when I was talking to investors was like, I felt like I didn't even know what I needed to know. Like there was so much to unpack. Commercial real estate, a multifamily specifically, is probably, if you learn it right and you learn every single piece of it, it is a lot. It is very heavy. It took me a year and a half to learn. It has, out of everything I've ever learned in life, it has taken me the longest to learn all the nuances on every single aspect. I don't recommend doing it that way, but I'm a type of person that I need to know like every single detail. So then once I know every single detail and how it all works, then I can create systems and scale it very quickly. So I was scared about talking to people because they would ask me questions that I felt like I didn't know. And then on top of that, I was also scared because I had a gut feeling that I was in a bad partnership situation. When I asked after the first week, like, who's managing the books, like the financials, and they said, oh, we look at them at the end of the month. And then the end of the month came and I asked again and they said, oh, we look at them at the end of the quarter. And then I realized that that group was more concerned about getting assets to get acquisition fees. They were very concerned about fees as opposed to operations. That was a very good lesson for me because I learned very quickly how important operations were. And that was a cornerstone for me moving forward on focusing on operations. And that is now what I'm known for. But I literally, even in the frothy market that used to be in Q1 of 2022, a multifamily, I was still just focusing on operations. I wasn't letting the market dictate my sales. And that has led me very well for, you know, the fallout of COVID and obviously all the turmoil we've seen in multifamily.
It's funny you say that because I think there's a lot of people that got fee hungry. They got fee, we call it commission breath. It's a broker, you know, but it's also fee hungry. And they weren't sticking to fundamentals. They were just looking, like you said, at the acquisition fee. They weren't forecasting in downside. I don't know, maybe rates are going to go up a lot. You know, and now these people are in trouble. And that we know, I mean, I'm hearing of a lot of syndicators, and we syndicate on a small level, Mitch and I with Cadia Capital, but we're hearing of a lot of syndicators that are in trouble and they're going to lose their investors' money.
Well, it's like Pavlov's dogs, right? They failed to operate and then people paid more for their property because interest rates went down. They literally did nothing and they were rewarded. So from Pavlov's dogs, we know in psychology that if you do something and you get rewarded for it, whether you do it right or do it wrong, you're going to tend to repeat those actions.
So what did you do during that time to make sure you didn't fall into the trap that a lot of syndicators fell into? Obviously, you had the years of experience behind you, but I'm curious to your mindset and then the actions you took or didn't take during that time when the market's frothy and anyone could buy anything at whatever cap rate and you know, resell in a few months. Like, what did you do? And what was your mindset like during that time to make sure that you weren't in that same position?
So the first property, the one I partnered with, I took over operations. I asked if I could take over operations. They were incredibly grateful because they were like, yes, someone else can, you know, have this problem. And I offered to take it over, but really I didn't know what I was doing. So I was blessed to have a regional manager who was very experienced and willing to show me the ropes, so to speak. And I spent hundreds of hours. And when I mean hundreds of hours, I can't even tell you how many nights until 2 a.m. we were on the phone talking and educating ourselves. I educated her on the investor side of things so she could understand that piece of it. And then she educated me on the day-to-day management, how other owners do certain things, and then allowed me to make my own decision on how I wanted to manage. So I think I also read a lot of books. I tried for every free resource at the time. To be honest with you, there weren't a lot of resources. And then what I did was, you know, I started to do it really well. I was so detail oriented. And my husband and I had a conversation about what if I positioned myself as someone who just did asset management and all these different companies could come to me and do asset management. So I did. I went out and I said, you know, all these accolades that I was able to achieve and position myself as, okay, partner with me. I'll run your asset and construction management. Over 6 months, I was sent 70 deals. I underwrote all of them. We went through the process. These are deals that are already under contract or people already had. And out of 70 deals, I only picked one to do because they were so poorly underwritten and it was so much speculative thinking. Like going back, Travis, to what we were talking about on the stock market, I don't believe in speculative thinking. Like I believe in operations. So to me, there was so much crystal ball, like, you know, guessing on where this market would be and the market would always carry you out. But I understood where we were in the market cycle. I studied market cycles. In fact, it's one of the reasons I picked Houston because it was one of only two markets in the entire country that was coming out of a recession where every other market in the country, almost every other market in the country was in hypersupply. They were overdue for a recession on the multifamily front. So then what I decided is, okay, this isn't sustainable either because too many people are risky in their underwriting. And I'm not talking by like a couple hundred thousand dollars. I'm talking about millions. So then we decided to create our own company. So in doing all of that, I think it was like a really good path and journey to see how other people underwrote, how other people were guessing on the market. And the one deal I did decide to do, that deal had a really bad inspector. And what ended up happening with that deal is we probably had about 50% of what we actually needed in CapEx. So that was another challenge for me to be like, okay, how do I maximize, you know, the underwriting and what we, our business plan was with the state of the property that I'm actually getting. You know, this is a property that obviously did really well because we exited during a great time to exit. The investors, the average annual return was 34, the IRR was 31. However, I say that though, but a big part of that though was because of the market cycle.
You sold to a frothy buyer, right?
Yes, you sold to a frothy buyer. But when you look at like, you know, the financials, we still overperformed our projections. We had mid to upper teens projections. And if you take out the frothiness of the market, where we would have been in the low 20s. So we still would have done well. We still focused on operations. But I gave a speech at Bigger Pockets 2 years ago, and it was like 400 people in the room. And I asked everyone in the room to raise your hand if you had exited a deal within the past year. And about 50% of the crowd raised their hand. Then I asked how many of those deals outperformed the original projections. And about 90% of the people still had their hands up. I asked how many people asked for the actual financials and compared them against the projected financials when they got their distribution. Who checked it? One person in the entire room. One person checked the financials. So it just goes to show you that, you know, when things are doing well and you have investors that are getting what they're supposed to or getting more, no one's questioning you. But inevitably, if you're in this business long enough, you will have people question you. So if you don't have the answers, if you haven't been operating, if you haven't been focusing, if you haven't been working on building a good team, scaling correctly, it can really bite you in the butt. So like you got to pay attention to the details.
When you presented a deal to investors and you're projecting X percent cash on cash, X equity multiple IRR, as you're in the deal and you're holding the deal, you're going back to check to see if you're on track. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So the way we present, I mean, every group presents data differently. And the way we present our data is we always present it based off of what we originally told you we would achieve, for better or for worse. And we talk about why we're overachieving. And we also talk about why we're underachieving. There is no perfect deal. You will never outperform on every metric. that's the reality of investing. It's risky. You're investing. It's not a guarantee. But to me, if you don't understand where the variance is for positive or negative, you can't really continue to operate. You can't continue to scale. You can't continue to figure out like what's going on right and what's going on wrong, because it's kind of like marketing. Like when you're marketing and you're spending all this money to get people to lease from your property, well, maybe it's not that people aren't seeing it. Maybe it's that you have a bad closer, or maybe it's that you have a bad process, or maybe it's you have bad screening, or maybe your website's really good if you're accessing from a desktop, but not good from a mobile device. Like these are all, and you know, everyone's using mobile now and to look up properties instead of desktop. Like these are all little nuances that I feel like, you know, is lost when you're not in day-to-day operations.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Ashley, I wanted to transition over a little bit. You wrote a book, The Only Woman in the Room. I'm curious about that book. Travis didn't know that women actually invested in real estate.
You're full of shit, Gabe.
I'm just kidding. But in an industry, you know, predominantly a lot of, you know, the majority of male investors, I'm curious about, you know, as a woman, you know, you have the book, The Only Woman in the Room. I'm curious, like, did you use that as like to your advantage? Were there challenges? You mentioned, you know, starting off the good old boys in Texas and having to get in that room. I'm curious to what that looked like. I know obviously you didn't let that hold you back in any way whatsoever. But I'm curious to your mindset kind of going through that when it is an industry that predominantly are a bunch of, you know, good old boy guy investors.
I think it's an advantage to be a woman in real estate, because there are fewer of us. We look different than everyone else who's coming through the door. We sound different. We look at things differently. So I think it's a huge advantage to be a woman. The reason I wrote the book, The Only Woman in the Room, obviously I told you my dad was a general contractor and, you know, surrounded by guys in real estate and construction, right? And then I went to an all boys school, high school. So my sophomore year, I went there and I think it was close to like 33, 34% girls and the rest were guys. So that, you know, didn't really notice and stand out. My senior year of college, I lived with all guys. I lived with 14 guys and just me. So like, I've always kind of felt more comfortable, to be honest with you, like in male, predominantly male settings. It wasn't until I attended a conference and the real estate investor community, the co-founders were there and asked if we could have lunch together. And out of 450 attendees, there were only 16 women who put two tables together and we all had lunch together, that I actually was like, oh my God, like, this is crazy. I never realized this. So driving on the way home, I was talking to my husband and I said, I'm going to write a book called The Only Woman in the Room. I don't know what it's going to look like, but it's going to be about women in real estate. And originally I was going to write it myself. And then I thought, why am I writing this book? And it's to get more diversity in real estate. And how do you get more diversity in real estate? You have more people that look like you on stage and having the spotlight on what they're doing. So I didn't tell women I was doing this, but I constantly interviewed women for a year without them knowing, and then picked 19 of those women to co-author the book with me. And the idea was, okay, all of these women will then attract more women because they all have different stories. They're from different backgrounds. Not everyone's from the US, for example. They're different ages, different sexual orientations, demographics. I mean, you name it. The point was that any single person who picks up the book, not just a woman, could relate to someone. So the most positive feedback that we've received collectively, to be honest with you, is from men. They're like, this literally is like a playbook on how to do X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, yeah, there's probably two sentences in the entire book talking about women being the only woman in the room. It's really just about all these different journeys, et cetera. And part of the reason behind that is I noticed every keynote speaker had a book. So I was like, okay, well then I'll give 19 other women a book. Like, not that I gave them one, but I was like, here's a platform. Let's all, you know, combine and do this together. So that's been like really kind of like a cool thing to be a part of and be a part of the investor community. What's interesting, and I always say that I'm like living this kind of like Slumdog Millionaire, like real life kind of life, is that I launched in February Conference Connect. And I kind of launched it on some of the same principles as why I wrote The Only Woman in the Room. So Conference Connect is an event and speaker discovery platform. And my thought is, okay, how do we get more speakers the availability to speak on stages, more diverse speakers? Well, we have a speaker database. So let's have a speaker database. People can review these speakers. And that way, when someone's looking for a certain type of speaker, they're more easy to find. So it's like a speaker resume. And then coupled with that is, okay, well, then if we have more diverse speakers on stages, we attract more diversity altogether, because people want to hear people who look like them. Like, that's why when you go to like a Grant Cardone event, like a lot of people in the audience look like Grant Cardone, right? So like, to be honest, you will attract a more diverse audience, will bring more diversity into the event space collectively. It's not real estate agnostic. And that will allow more opportunities for everyone.
Can you imagine a conference with Mitch as the keynote?
Everybody would be so good looking. It'd be like the best place. That's like heaven.
I don't know. A lot of our tribe looks a lot more like Ashley than they do us. So it's interesting. But I love that.
Yeah.
I think we should get your book out to all of our members. I think it would be an awesome read. We have a lot of women in our tribe and men too. So that's really cool.
Hey Ashley, I got a question for you about multifamily. I'm just curious to get your take. It's October of 2024 right now. People have said multifamily's kind of gone through a winter. We were just talking to other investors sort of in our own circles where people are saying they're starting to see more deals come out, more distressed deals as debt's resetting, that it's been tough, not just on the sort of the finance investor, you know, make money side, but also the operation side, rents and things like that. If you were to sort of sum up the state of multifamily real estate in 2024 and where it's heading, you know, with rates and, you know, the viability of the asset class, et cetera, how would you coin that?
Like I said, from the beginning, multifamily was due for a reset. If you looked at where we were in the market cycle, COVID, I call COVID an accelerator event. It was an accelerator for technology. It was accelerator for market cycles. So we saw this like run up of the tail end of the hyper supply that we had in terms of like, you know, we had this huge push on rents. And then all of a sudden, like in a hyper supply market, typically there's too much supply. So there was all this forecasting of too much supply very early on. And I was one of the first people to say, hey, that's not true. That's not accurate. Because how are you gauging hyper supply? How are you gauging all this supply that's coming online? You're doing it off of permits, and permits aren't indicators that work is actually being done and that product is going to be delivered. We have a run-up of interest rates, one of the fastest run-ups of all time. And when you look back at new builds, they have to forecast out 18 to 24 months on where that interest rate's going to be. No one forecasted the run-up on interest rates. So a lot of projects were dead in the water. I mean, I'm still getting calls from brokers on projects that are halfway done because they need someone who has construction experience to finish out these projects, right? But in terms of where we're at today, we're at still a holding pattern. And I would definitely say things are still a huge struggle. And they're a huge struggle for a lot of reasons. Number one is legislation. Legislation has still not lifted from COVID. There is so much kind of handholding of residents and letting a lot of forgiveness happen due to loss of jobs and or, you know, just any sort of excuse that can happen. I mean, just to kind of give one case study, you know, you go from Houston where you had an eviction cycle of 30-day period, which a lot of people underwrote to now we're seeing on average 60 to 90 days plus. That's just not sustainable, right? That's not going to attract investors. Investors go where their money is treated best. That's not going to continue to happen. Number two is insurance. Insurance is such a struggle right now. You have Florida that I called years ago is going to be uninsurable and it's fast tracking its way there, that you're going to have people who can no longer afford to be in Florida because the properties are uninsurable. The same thing is happening in Texas. It was the second highest insurance hike, and we continue to see those insurance hikes. Third is you have the challenges when it comes to real estate taxes. So we had these huge run-ups in valuation. Now we're seeing cooling off. So there's all these adjustments going on. It's one of the highest tax protests, especially in the state of Texas, that we've seen historically. So you have all of these challenges to operations that I think are making it very difficult to continue to own and operate these properties. So, and don't even get me started with the election and all the potential legislation changes there, because the bottom line is, and you know, people like to argue this whole thing about, you know, the tax cuts and benefits and incentives. But the bottom line is the government is tasked with all of these responsibilities to get things done. For example, roads and housing. And they have a decision to make on whether or not they tax everyone and they solve the issue, or they provide tax loopholes for the wealthy and incentivize them to help fix the problem. And if the advantage is for the wealthy to pursue you know, housing as an example, which historically it's been to help solve this issue, and all of a sudden it becomes harder, they're going to turn and look elsewhere. So the reason I bring this up is because right now our interest rates are not in a situation where people are encouraged to go out and sell their property. In fact, it's one of the slowest quarters, and it's predicted to be one of the slowest quarters of transactions, because people are expecting the interest rates to fall. And, you know, we had that rate cut in September, but the 10-year treasury went up, which everyone thought the treasury would go down. So we need some more time to go along. We need some more, to be honest with you, it's like when things are good, it's actually bad news. We need bad news reports for things to be good again. We need bad job reports, right? We need a bad CPI. We need all of these metrics that the Fed uses to dictate interest rates and help with the 10-year treasury so that we can actually get things going again.
I like how they redefine the reports, though. They're like, oh, this is how we're going to report this data now. It's going to report good news. Like the job report, you're like, is that because everybody has three jobs now? Because
yeah, there's so many part-time jobs, right, that are included in the reports. And they're like, oh, well, we have all these jobs. And it's like, yeah, but they're part-time.
Well, shame on Texas, by the way, for that. Shame on Texas for villainizing landlords. And it's like I always say, when they're doing that during COVID, they're being generous with your money, right? When they let residents live in your properties for free, they're like, you know, I tell my kids, what is it called when you're being friend, being generous with somebody else's money? It's called socialism.
Well, we also have, you know, data points that they're saying have a 12-month lagging effect, right? But now, like interest rates, they're like, well, we're not going to see, you know, the impact for 12 months, but then fast forward when interest rates are being cut now, we're supposed to see it immediately. It's like the story is not jiving, right? So I just think there's a lot of challenges when it's hard to see which one's going to be the front runner that is the catalyst. But right now, I think a lot of shops are holding. I mean, there are people looking for properties for end of year tax write-offs, but I think there are a lot of people because your funding gets reset in January, which, by the way, is the reason why National Multifamily Housing Conference is always at the end of January when all the deals get released for the year. It's to time it with the new release of equity for all of these PE groups.
How do you hedge your bets now? Like, what are you guys doing? I mean, as you look on the horizon?
We're still looking for properties. I mean, we never turn off acquisitions. I'm a believer that always is a time to buy. Like, it's never like a bad time to buy. I've interviewed a lot of people during the last recession to ask them what they did. And they said they bought up as many things as they could. I actually heard a saying the other day. I thought it was really a good saying, that you should buy when there's blood in the street, even if it's your own blood. And I thought that was really a great saying, because I think when people are fearful and, you know, they're bleeding, they get fearful of taking action and continuing the things that they've historically done. It doesn't mean that you continue to make the same mistakes, but you should still look for buying opportunities. So we're still looking to buy in terms of selling the assets we have. We're in the same camp as probably everyone else, which is, you know, probably Q1 of 2025 is a better time to look to sell.
I love that saying though, even if it's your own blood in the street. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
I know we're toward the end of this podcast, but like, I'm going to kill myself if I don't ask you this question. I'm taking it in a slightly different direction, but I like listening to you over this last hour, reading your bio, like learning more about you. I'm like, what is your why? And like, what drives you? Cause we're seeing all the byproduct of what you do every day, but like, what is that? Does that come from some experience or is there something? Cause I'm just like thoroughly impressed with you and what you've built.
Well, first of all, thank you. That means a lot. I think I've had a little bit of a combination of a why and a chip on my shoulder. So my why is when I was younger, my mom and dad were always there for me. And we didn't grow up wealthy at all, but I was always surrounded by wealth. So I always had a scholarship to go to private school and my university. And all of those institutions attracted a lot of wealthy people. So I always saw a lot of wealth and I was around a lot of wealth, but I had a very different experience growing up. You know, my dad had to heat the pipes in the winter. So we had go outside and heat them because our pipes to our house for hot water were outside the house. And we lived in Pennsylvania and it snowed in the winter, right? So very, very different experience than, you know, my friends growing up. So, but what I was really grateful for, and I'm grateful for my parents for teaching me to appreciate this, is that at every school event, at every sporting event, both of my parents were there and they were there for me and they were there for my brother. And the way they were able to do that is my mom worked for a small business in operations and my dad had his own business as a general contractor. And, you know, during different market cycles, I specifically remember my dad would go periods of time with no work because, you know, we're seeing it today. Home Depot, I just heard yesterday, is laying off 80,000 people, right? Because people aren't doing as much home renovation anymore. And, you know, I felt that firsthand as a kid. I remember that. I remember having my winter jacket on layaway at a store to be able to have a winter jacket. I remember those things. To me, when people ever ask me what I wanted to be growing up, it always changed because it changed to whatever was the thing that I knew was the most amount of money you can make. So the reason I went into pharma was because I learned that, okay, well, if I was a CEO of a company, I could make millions of dollars a year. And then that would put me in a position where I could be with my kids all the time. Well, in pharma, I started to realize how much of a golden handcuff situation that was. The more money I made, the less freedom I had to actually be there for my family. The whole reason that I do what I do now is to always be able to. Earlier today, my daughter had a book fair and my husband and I both went to the book fair. So the reason why I do everything is to be there for my kids. Now, obviously, there are a lot of different career paths that could have taken me on that path, but I also still think I have that chip on my shoulder of being that kid who, you know, was surrounded by people who had like extraordinary wealth. I went to school with the Trumps. Okay. So that's like the disparity between my life and like, you know, my friend at the time, Eric, when I was in high school. Right. So like, to me, like it was just a very completely different experience. And I feel like I've never really, maybe I should be in therapy for it, but I've never really gotten over that. So it's continued to drive me to crazy levels. And I don't think like it's so ingrained in me now that I don't think I would ever be able to like not work until, you know, like 11 o'clock at night. I pull all nighters at least once a month. I work every single day. Like I think it's just so ingrained in me to like never stop.
What I respect the most about, I mean, obviously that whole answer was incredible, but like, first of all, your parents, maybe they didn't have all the money in the world, but they were far more successful than parents that chase money at the expense of being there for their kids. And so I think that that's amazing. And I think it's amazing today you work so hard and you're building something, but then you go right back to the core of it. The core of it being like, I was at my daughter's book fair. And like, I think we can get lost in the pursuit of money or material or goals or aspirations or competing with people. And we forget that like when we're at the end of our life, we're not going to give a shit about most of those things. It's going to be your kids' kids. And so I love that like ending this podcast on that feels just so powerful. And I'm like, I respect you for that.
Thank you.
And I meant the end game. Like, do you guys have a specific goal that you're trying to build your company to? Is it a portfolio? Is it a holding? Is it, do you guys think through that? Or is it just keep doing what you're doing, have fun, build wealth, and use the vehicle you've built to have choices in life, which is what you've created for yourself, which is what we're all about. Like, it gives you choices to do things, to go to your kids' book fair or to quit or work. You can work hard or you can not work hard. Like, that's up to you because you've created a vehicle that gives you choices. Is there a goal for your companies that you would like to achieve at this point?
For each company, we have different goals. For me personally, I think a lot of people think I'm an integrator, but I'm an integrator out of necessity. I'm actually a true visionary. And I constantly come up with ideas. The hardest problem that I ever have is picking which idea to pursue, which is why it's so perfect. I'm married to the dream crusher, aka the crotchety Canadian. Kyle is my husband. So he is really good at killing almost all of my ideas, but he didn't kill Conference Connect. He actually was pushing me when I thought that it wasn't a viable idea. So I think overall, like my husband and I have had this conversation a lot of times because he's like, when's enough? Like, I'm trying to think of this song. It's like a Jay-Z song and he's like, and another one and another one. Like he always sings that to me because it's like never enough for me. Like
goes, I always want
more. Yeah. And he's like, you'll just like work till you die. Like you will be working as they're carrying your casket to like the final burial ground kind of thing. And I think that's true. Like there's some sick like thing about me that I actually do enjoy. Like I know people say, oh, I enjoy working and they really don't. Like I enjoy being mentally stimulated. So flipping for me was mind-numbing after I figured out how to scale it. Because once I scaled it to me, it was so boring. The reason why multifamily has captivated my attention and it's something that I've stuck with for a long time is because there's so many nuances to it that change and make it like this jigsaw puzzle that the rules constantly change. And I love that I have to figure it out. Like I hate it, but I love it. Like it's a sick problem I have.
Ashley, we have one final question that we ask all our guests. Travis, you want to go ahead and ask the final question?
Sure. Okay. So you've lost everything. And we call you're sitting on your buddy's couch. You have lost all of your money. You've lost all of your real estate. You still have your knowledge, everything that you've learned, you still have, but here's the kicker. You've lost your network. And we all know network is like the lifeblood of a real estate, any business really is your network. Like, what do you do that first week? What do you do that first month? What do you do that first year to build it back? And I know you'll do it. Like you're going to like, of all the guests we've probably had on this show, I'm like, oh yeah, of course, Ashley will be back where she's maybe 3 years and she'll be maybe ahead of where she's at now. Cause you're an ass kicker, but like,
but what's the first thing? What's the first thing you do?
Yeah. Exactly. First thing.
To me, your network is your net worth. That saying is so critical. And to me, it's not having a pity party. Like I would not be sitting on a couch. Like that's number one. Like I would get up, I would leave, I would start networking, and I would also start asking. So if I'm on my buddy's couch, I have my buddy, right? I'm starting with my buddy. I'm having a conversation with my buddy. And I'm like, hey, like, you know, whatever we're pursuing or whatever I'm pursuing, like, let's have a conversation there. And who do you know who would be interested in X, Y, and Z? And then get those leads and then go there. And I would just hit the pavement so hard. I would do so much guerrilla marketing and I would just never quit. And then on top of that, I'd be very strategic at it because let's say, for example, I'm on the East Coast. My buddy's on the East Coast. not only do I ask my buddy, like, hey, who do you know on the East Coast? Who do you know in Central Time Zone? Who do you know in Pacific Time Zone? Because I'm going to structure all of my outreach based on where they are. So I extend out my day so I can reach people at optimal times to talk to them and then grow from there. But I am like not quitting. I am literally building out my network again and figuring out how I can like spiderweb the whole thing. Because ultimately you start off and it's that 6 degrees to Kevin Bacon, but the people who are at the top are 1 degree away from Kevin Bacon. And that doesn't necessarily mean 1 degree away from Kevin Bacon, the actual Kevin Bacon. The point is you should always be 1 degree away from the person you need to get information from. So how do I get myself from 6 degrees away from the person that I need to get to one? And it's all about talking to that person, not only getting value out of that person and providing value however you can, because you should always lead with value, but then seeing who in their network you can also tap into. So I would just rebuild my network as fast as possible and start with the buddy on the couch.
So many great answers within that answer. I love that you said, yeah, I love that you're like, I'd get off the couch.
Get your ass off the couch, first of all. Are these people that you're connecting to, are you building a real estate portfolio again? Are you doing something completely different? Are you talking to potential investors? Are you looking for properties? Are you pairing capital with deals? Because you have your knowledge, right? Or are you like, maybe not real estate, maybe something else completely?
I mean, personally, I think the fastest way to grow back your network is to lean into your strengths you already have. I'm a huge proponent for lean into your strengths and provide value. So for me, it would be to build your real estate portfolio all over again. Now, obviously, if the environment had changed, if policies had changed, like, you know, I would take into consideration the situational construct. But at the same time, like, I know what my value is. I know what I'm good at. I know my strengths. I do almost all of our hiring. And when I do our hiring, the number one issue that I find with hiring is majority of people don't know themselves. They know who other people believe them to be, so they act as if they're that person. So for example, I said earlier, most people think that I'm an integrator, but I'm actually truly a visionary. So when I test, my natural ability is actually visionary. I test knowing that people think I'm an integrator, but I still act as a visionary. I only act as an integrator out of necessity. But there are a lot of people who know they're a visionary. People think they're an integrator, so they act as an integrator. And I think you always have, you're working against the grade if you continue to work and operate that way. I know myself really well. I think that's one of the strongest things that you can do and spend time on. I've done a lot of personal development to figure out and be comfortable with who I am. It's taken time and a lot of work, but I think it's something that can be extremely valuable and helpful. For example, I'm not good at raising money, but I'm good at networking. So like, it's kind of similar skill sets, but they are different, right? And what's interesting is if you were to say, okay, would you go out and start raising money? Well, I know I'm naturally not good at it, but I am good at finding properties and networking and getting people to like me and trust me and provide proof that I'm, you know, on the up and up. So I think to me, like, I would lean into those strengths. I wouldn't pretend to be someone I'm not, which is kind of taking this podcast like full circle. I kind of started with that, like, be who you are authentically are, be your authentic self. And I think that can provide a lot of value to a lot of people.
So inspirational.
Awesome. Awesome podcast episode, Ashley. I genuinely appreciate you being on here. This has been an amazing podcast episode.
Seriously.
How do people get a hold of you, Ashley? And we'll put it in the show notes as well.
The easiest way is on Instagram, Badash Investor. From there, you can link to a lot of different things that I'm doing, but that's the easiest way that you can follow me and find out more about our companies.
You used to be in my phone as Badash Investor.
A couple months, we need to have you back because I feel like there's going to be like 3 or 4 more businesses and there's going to be like another book and there's going to, anyway. Mm. Yeah, we need to do a follow up.
Yeah. And I like your handle. People just call me an ass. And they just leave it at that.
So, that's true.
Badass Investor. So,
just ass.
And Mitch Hull Investor.
That's true. That's unfortunately.
You got to do Travass.
Travass. Travass investor. Gosh, she's
taking me back to elementary school, Ashley.
Yeah. The Travis.
Travass and Mitchell. This is great. All right. Badass investor, Ashley Wilson. Thank you for being on the 0 to 100 podcast show.
Thank you, Ashley.
We appreciate you.
Thank you.